Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 2nd, 1999, and in Quinnia Fireside Room this evening is John Olson and Roland Halverson's session called For the Love of Money, number 99-1. Let's listen in.
My name is Roland Halverson. I'm a pastor, retired Alexandria, Minnesota. I once did some special work in my DMIN program having to do with money and those kinds of issues or dilemmas. John Olson, Minneapolis, and I were asked to do a forum this evening. We don't intend to lecture or tell you or what to do about whatever, but to simply, I'm going to give a point of view that we roughly will call, well, John used the word spiritual, and he is going to give a point of view that he roughly called secular. I hope that it won't be all that much divergent, probably, when we get done at the end. But we also know that some of you have stories to tell, and we want you to have a chance to do that, too. So we'll try not to take up too much time. You see that figure behind me?
Several.
I want you to think about several of those figures. We're talking about big bucks, right? You should be impressed. Well, that actually, John's going to talk about those. Let's start with a word of prayer. Dear Lord God, we thank you from the bottom of our hearts and the depths of our pockets that you love cheerful givers, grumpy givers, and all of us in between, for Jesus' sake. Amen. A famous French philosopher, I don't think it was part of a stewardship program, once said, when it comes to money, everyone is of the same religion. That religion is not Christian. When it comes to money, everyone is of the same religion. But not Jesus, of course. He said a lot of things about money. No one can serve both God and mammon. He talked about the problem a rich man will have passing through the eye of a needle, the story of the rich ruler, the parable of the rich farmer who pulls down his barns, and so on and so on. Money promises security, happiness, love, hope, the abundant life, even immortality, if you know how to put it in the right place to have your name attached. It's like a religion. It's like an alternative religion. It is a parallel religion for many of us in our culture. Money has an addictive power. If an addiction is that which, around which we organize our lives and our activities in kind of a primary way, then certainly money does have quite an addictive power. And if denial is one of the most common reactions to addictions, any addiction, then maybe the reason why most of us, and I think this is true, why most of us have trouble thinking that what Jesus says about money applies to me, is that we are in denial. And isn't that basically true? Well, we know, we've all read the many things that Jesus has said in the New Testament about money, and yet very few of us, well, many of us anyway, probably don't think it really applies to me or to us. And that may well be because we're in denial about its addictive power. So what to do? Father Capon talks about sass back at the money god. We need to dethrone the money god, the power of money in our lives. We need to be free of its power. I went to a basic workshop sponsored by the Ministry of Money. You heard of that organization? It's an interdenominational organization in our across the country. And one of the things we did at the end of that was to express our freedom and joy of being free from money, at least for a little bit, was simply throw a lot of money on the floor. Well, picture yourself doing that, just throwing a lot of money on the floor, just to get the idea that you want to be free of it, or at least that we should be more free of it. We all need to be more free of the bondage that money can be in our lives. And in a sense, it doesn't matter what you do with the money, or that you give it to certain kinds of needs. You need to learn to give it the whole lunch. Thank you, Chuck. Recklessly, extravagantly, generously, it's the best way to become more free from money and its addictive power, money and its bondage. And the best way to do that, according to some research that I did and according to some of the research done by the ELCA Office of Research and Analysis, and they have a lot of good things about money and stewardship that probably few people know much about, the best way to reach people is by preaching. You know, they compared the preaching with relay methods and college meetings and on and on and on. The most effective way to talk to people about money is preaching. In terms of the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods, and in terms of the gospel and its power and promises in our lives. And I want to say that I think for most of us we ought to think, and we can defend this, I think, biblically, at least in terms of 10%, the tithe, the laws of the tithe, Sabbath, usury, gleaning and hospitality, the year of Jubilee, all of those laws given by God to the people of Israel in the Old Testament were given by God to Israel that she might be able to remain more free and not return to the bondage that she had been in before in Egypt. For example, you read about the tithe in Deuteronomy 14. Only every third year was the tithe kept for the sake of the Levites and the widows and the poor. Otherwise, the tithe was generally used for the mother of all church potlucks, and the rest of it was burnt up. They didn't need that kind of money. The Lord asked for a tenth, but there was no budget. Very little religious organizations. They didn't have camps in the Cascades. They didn't have needs like we have now. Well, that's good, I suppose. We need to be glad that when we give, our money can be given to something that is worthwhile, not simply burnt on the altar so it makes smoke that goes up to heaven, representing our faith and our understanding of God's place in our lives. But we need to learn to give regardless of needs, without talking about needs. And maybe the best way is what I've sometimes called the shoebox model. It's a story about a farmer in the past who, when he went to town, would sell cream, eggs, milk, grain. And when he would come home, he would always put at least a tenth in the shoebox on the mantle. And then the family along the line would decide how that money was going to be given, how it was going to be distributed, how it was going to be used, most of it probably to the church, but then to other kinds of organizations and special causes and needs. Otherwise, if we don't think in those terms, we are only talking about fundraising in the church. And John's going to talk about this. This is going to lead to nothing but guilt and coercion. If we can't remember the difference between real giving and our need to give just because we need to give, and tell you about needs. But too often, and we call it in our ELCA anyway, mission interpretation. It seems like that almost always is a part of any kind of talk about money. Giving everybody the impression that really it's a big, and you ought to give, you need to give, because these are great needs that need to be taken care of. When we do that, we're still in bondage. And we still have the money God. We need to learn how to let God be God in our lives and to sass back at the money God and dethrone the money God from our lives. That, I think, is really important. Also, like I mentioned in the prayer, always remember that, as Paul said, God loves the cheerful giver, but in other places you can easily find out that Paul would also say that God loves the grumpy givers and the non-givers.
So is that it? Thank you, Roland. Are you all in bondage or in denial or guilt?
All of the above.
all of you. Thank you for coming. I'm John Olson. I serve Holden as a member of the board, and for the last 35 years, I've been a professional fundraiser. I've probably been responsible for seeing about $400 million be raised for various organizations of one kind or another, primarily higher education, and the last 22 years in healthcare. I've learned a few things in that time, and some of those I wish to share with you today. But I'm going to sort of take an approach that is more organizational in its structure than some of the theological approaches that my colleague has just used. But I'd like to start by, can you all see this top number up here? It's kind of hard with the glare. But this number right here, so anybody want to guess, what's the size of that number? Don?
That's like 20
trillion. $20 trillion. That's that number. And this 2015 represents the year 2015. In the United States of America, $20 trillion, a minimum of $20 trillion will change hands from one generation in this country to the next. That's about, what, 4.5-5 times the size of the U.S. national debt? That asset base is going to change hands from one generation to another. In fact, some people are saying already that this 20 million is too conservative. It's probably going to be closer to $40 trillion is going to move from one generation to another. The question we have as the people of God and the question we have as people is basically, how are we going to move that? And where will it go? And what will we do with it? It's the most money that has ever moved from one generation to another. And the wealth in the country is continuing to skyrocket. In 1998, 120,000 individuals became billionaires for the first time. It's estimated that in 1999, 200,000 will become millionaires for the first time. And some people are already projecting that at the end of the year 2000, which is actually the official end of the millennium, that this number will be about 400,000 new first-time millionaires. Anybody want to share?
Can I just add that $1 trillion in $10 new bills stacked up will reach from Earth to the Moon. That's $1 trillion.
Well, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of asset. Most of this, by the way, is in appreciated assets. It's in stocks, it's in bonds, it's in real estate, it's in convertible asset growing kinds of instruments. And it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal number. And you people here represent a generation that may be receiving it as well as a generation that may be passing it on. What I'd like to talk about for a few minutes, and this is to be a forum, not a lecture, and that is we want your participation in this. But what I'd like to do is just take a few minutes and talk about four major motivators that kind of drive giving by individuals. Some of them are words you know, and maybe I'll put them in a context that's a little different than what you might have heard before or have not thought of it in. But I want to share them with you because all the work that's been done over the years in motivation of giving sort of boils down to these four. The first one is the motivator of self-interest. The first person to ever benefit from a gift is the one who makes the gift. And they will not make a gift if they do not determine in their own mind that it's to their self-interest to do so. Think of your own giving. You give to things that you don't have any interest in as an individual. We always give to those things that, in fact, we have an interest in personally to begin with. And this is, in many ways, a selfish act because we are the first one to benefit. And yet it becomes, in the long run, as I'll get a little farther in my comments, a selfless act. But it's the first and the major motivator for people's giving. The second one was referred to by my colleague, guilt. We as a church are really good at that. We've practiced that for a very long time. But guilt is the second major motivator for why people make gifts. Have you ever used guilt or had guilt used with you? No, Ron, you know that's not true. Not you. You're probably the only one in the room that's never experienced it. Guilt as a motivator. Let me give you an example that just happened in the newspaper in Minneapolis about 3 weeks ago. Headline story in the Star Tribune. Dr. Udall, president, University of Minnesota, is quoted, and I'll sort of paraphrase it, but he's quoted by saying, "Shame on you, Minnesotans. You don't give enough money to the University of Minnesota, and our faculty is only the 20th best paid faculty in the United States, and we need to do better." Guilt. Absolute, straight out, abject guilt.
Did it work?
As the motivator. We don't know yet. That was only 3 weeks ago, but probably. Probably, because Minnesota, 42% of the people are Catholic, 38% are Lutheran, and they're all guilt-driven, so it will work. Dr. Udall is Jewish, so he understands it well himself. So I'm sure it all will work that way. The third major motivator is coercion. Coercion and guilt work together in many different ways. Coercion is a major motivator and driver of the process. The people who use coercion are people like me, fundraisers who talk to people like you, and we find ways to coerce you into supporting us. The fifth, or supporting our causes or our interests, and I'll get to that in just a minute. The fourth major driver or motivator is altruism. Pure, abject, out-and-out altruism. How many of you remember back Psychology 101 and Maslow's hierarchy of needs? There's a humongous amount of Maslow in these motivators and the way, in fact, they are put together. And I would commend to you, not that this could be another whole session together on Maslow's thoughts alone, but I commend you to read that again sometime if you get a chance and try to look at those from the perspective that you bring at it at the age you are today. Guilt and coercion are the major two of these four that I want to emphasize, because I think the change that has to come in the future is to move away from those and move towards a new sense of grace and gratitude as the drivers that we in fact use in our giving decisions. When I talk about self-interest, I wanted to talk a little bit about needs, because people give to fulfill their needs first, not the organization's needs. And too many organizations claim that in fact it's their needs that are important, and although you may have some, yours are less important than theirs, and we want you to give to their needs, not to your needs. What we must do in that particular situation is find a way to help people see that the organization, like a Holden Village, or your college, or your church even, is in fact a solution place for the needs that you've identified within yourself. And we must think from a solutions perspective rather than from a needs perspective as organizations, as churches, as colleges, as whatever it might be. Comments. Does this rub anybody wrong? Do you agree with this? Disagree with either one of the comments that we've made to this point? Or we can all go home early. Does it bother you that we talk about greed and coercion as major drivers and drivers that we use and that our church uses to cause us to give? Or don't you think that happens?
Yeah.
All right. With guilt and coercion, anybody approaching me for a gift to any cause that uses guilt or coercion will not get a positive response. I don't do guilt. I don't do coercion. Sorry.
And I commend you for that. However, it's not always something that is readily seen by the person being solicited. And in many times, it's a response that you have internally, not at something that is brought to you. It's the way, in fact, you see something go forward. Yes, ma'am.
A lot of employers say, "I want 100% giving to United Fund."
Is that coercion, maybe? What happens if you don't give to the United Fund? You feel guilty.
Well, you hear about it too. They say, "Oh, just a dollar, even, but something," so they can say they have 100% participation.
Is that a useful process, do you think? Is that something that causes you to really identify well with United Way and the programs of the United Way?
No, it gets them some money.
Yeah. But what's the end here? Is the end only to get the money? Or is the end to create solutions for organizations and those people they serve and satisfaction for you as a human? There's some wonderful work going on at Stanford University in the Graduate School of Psychology right now that is taking a look at the whole issue of the genetic base to giving as part of being human. And frankly, they think they've discovered a combination of genes that are latent in the human species. But in fact, if properly motivated or educated, so to speak, can in fact cause people to understand giving better, understand how it meets a personal need within their life to fulfill themselves as human, and go forward from there. It will be fascinating if in fact that holds up. Because if in fact it is genetic, it'll change the way in which we should approach the education of philanthropy within individuals.
Are there others that say it all depends on how you were toilet trained? Psychological approach, in other words.
Jim?
Something to do with giving and retention.
Yeah.
I think it was Ron who made a distinction between fundraising and something else. And I'm not sure what that something else is and what the distinction is that you're making there. About that, son.
I was simply trying to say that as believers and as Christians, we need to give because we need to give. We need to be told that over and over and again in the kind of world in which we live with big bucks like this. And where that money goes, it doesn't matter all that much to us. Fundraising, that is, someone coming in and saying, you ought to give to this or that. I think fundraising has a place if one has already decided, let's say, to dedicate so much of one's assets, funds, whatever one has, and see that I need to give that much away in order to free myself up in terms of money and the money grab. Fundraising can come in and say, okay, would you please give part of that to this particular cause or need? But it ought to be secondary, I think, to a person's having fought through the whole issue, at least from the point of view of faith. In terms of simply, I give because I give, I need to give.
Ron, yeah, that comment struck me because the community that I work in, this so-called low income, for the first probably 6 years, every church I went to, good folks, good meaning folks, would ask me, point blank, every church, bar none, said, what do you need? And at first, we need food. Oh well, we need this, we need that. And then what struck me was, it was getting not only irritating, it was a lot. It was as if you could fulfill a certain need, and then you were off the hook, and everything was just dandy.
Exactly.
And what I really learned was what you were saying is community. In other words, it's a very interesting shift if you give because of you want to see community rise. You will have a different need than going out looking for money for the sewer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, for me, the shift of what you're at least have mentioned versus the old needs. And I'm thinking of a very specific family, the Dennis Bakke family, who's a multimillionaire in International Electronics, who was written up in Stanford and in the Harvard Journal of Business this year. And the whole point of the Bakkes are, by the way, Northwestern people, and Mustard Seed Foundation and all the rest. What they did as a family was come together, and he made so much money. He just said, well, we only need this much to live well. I mean, they live well, don't get me wrong. But then the rest of the money simply went into this huge foundation now, which has multiplied. And then they decide how to distribute. That's a different picture than the old need. Well, Holden needs this, needs that, and God, everybody needs something. But the community is a different picture of giving.
When you talk about needs driven, make sure you separate in your mind the difference between the needs an organization might have and the needs the individual has to
right.
give.
Exactly.
Because those are very different. And you need to understand that it's the need the individual has to give to complete themselves as human. That's what the Stanford study is getting towards. That, in fact, is the major driver of that gift not what in fact the gift goes to, which was the point you were making.
Okay. The reverse then is the Ministry of Money, by the way, which is a wonderful organization for anybody, is precisely, we have told and over, John, it's more blessed to give than receive. And what I'm saying from the poor end then, why aren't we allowing the people who could give there? We don't look to those as gifts. So when the community rises and says, we have this to give, let them receive the blessing. That's not what we do. And we have deceived ourselves in thinking caritas, charity, whatever you want to call it, is what is being done.
Yes, sir.
There's an old saying in the money business, and that's money isn't everything, but it keeps the kids in touch. You've got that whole barrier to go through. And don't people give to meaning? I mean, I don't think they give out of guilt. I think people...
Guilt I'm referring to as a driver to cause people to give, not necessarily that they give out of guilt.
But I think the driver...
They respond to it.
But the driver is meaning. The coffers of the church are going down. It seems like the church has to bring more meaning to the people.
I think, though, our problem has been that when we've come to the people of the churches, we've begged them to give for the budget and other special needs and causes that the church has. That's not the way to approach people. That's really what I've been trying to say. We need to preach the first commandment, no other gods before me, and make sure they understand that our need to give depends upon our relationship with God, not on the needs of the church. And I need to give in such a way that I become free of the money god, and that doesn't play a part in my life or hurt my life. Jesus said you can't serve both God and mammon, but most of us like to try.
Isn't this, to be a little crass about it, I mean, your religious point of view and Maslow's hierarchy and the Stanford study in genetics are all pointing to the same thing, that there's this need to give. And, in terms of, the scientific study of Stanford is maybe substantiating what the religious people have discovered over the centuries. And it sounds like it's all the same thing, and we have to try and convince people of that, because it's not the way we've been grown up to think.
What I think is simply so hard for us in this kind of a society that we just need to hear it again and again in order for it to get through our hearts and heads.
Ron?
St. Paul has two so-called fundraising chapters in 8 and 9 of 2 Corinthians. Part of that, he says, you will be enriched in every way for your great generosity. And there's a part of me that thinks that's the way to motivate people out of the grace point of view, New Testament. Ron, is from your approach, it's my observation that we tend as Lutheran Christians to be shy of going to the law to instruct on stewardship. Could you speak to that issue? Do we need to go to the law, number one, and should the law of the tithe be raised up, continually raised up as the standard, and beyond?
I think we need to go to the law in terms of the first commandment, because it's so very easy for any of us, for all of us, to worship money and make money an idol in our lives. I think we need to talk about that again and again and again, and say that one way then, in the love of God and because of the grace of Christ, the one way to be free of that is to give recklessly, generously, extravagantly. The tithe is a biblical model, not even new to the Old Testament. It goes way back to Abraham and Melchizedek, whoever he was. And that goes before the time of Abraham and the history of the Jewish people. It's thought that probably the tithe became a model for giving gifts to the divine because people had 10 fingers, and back in the prehistoric whatever days that you were on, they could easily count 1/10. It was a lot easier than 1/9 or 1/7 because you had 10 fingers. That's just a model. That's just a model, I think, but it's a biblical model. It's been used in the centuries and has some validity, and we ought to at least look at it and think about it a lot because it's in the scriptures.
A couple of other numbers, and then we'll come back to your questions that you may not be familiar with. In 1998, people in the United States living gave away $180 billion, passed it from themselves and their assets to not-for-profit organizations of one kind or another in the United States.
52% of that went to churches. So the churches are the largest recipient of the gift dollar. But the average individual in the United States gives about 1.96% of their adjusted gross income.
So that's after
taxes? After taxes. 1.96% of the adjusted gross after taxes.
What about the Lutheran Church, do you know?
Who knew that? Somebody else thought it's 2-something.
2.8.
It's a little higher. It's a little higher. What's that?
It's dropped. It's not, it used to be 2.8. We're closer to 2 now.
Closer.
St. Paul Area Synod is 1.6.
Okay. So it's back to the national average. Lutherans aren't any different than the rest of the world.
Well, on that line,
St. Paul Synod.
Why is it that Lutherans in Minnesota and North and South Dakota give less per capita than any place else in the country? Why is it that black Christians, on average, are much more generous than white Christians? Why is it that poor people give, percentage-wise, much more than rich people?
Yeah, the largest givers, percentage-wise, in the United States are people who make less than $30,000 a year, percentage of their income. You had a question, Ann?
Well, I was just going to make the comment that I think it's just, you were talking about how, both talking about how deeply ingrained the importance of money is, and to the point of being, and I think any of us who have gone overseas, I think one of the things you realize if you go to a third world country, when I went during the 80s to Central America, during the Contra War and El Salvador, I discovered that I just assumed that people that didn't have monetary resources had to be miserable. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that I thought that until I went to a place where people had just a tar paper shack or less and seemed happier than most of my neighbors. And I suddenly realized, you know, I really do believe that there's a certain level of monetary resources you must have in order to be happy.
Did you go on a Ministry of Money pilgrimage?
No, it was through Center for Global Education.
Yeah, they do that kind of a pilgrimage to prove that very thing.
And it is, it's just a, it's like a light going on to realize that, I mean, no matter I think who we are as Americans, and I can't go beyond that, we really, it is part of our way of thinking, that there is some level which below which if we went financially, we would have to be miserable. We couldn't be happy.
And we might find the opposite to be true if we start giving it away and freeing ourselves up in terms of money.
Yes, ma'am.
As a professional fundraiser who's usually dealing with people wishing to make very large gifts, and usually in a non-Christian setting, I find that people quite often want to accomplish something. Mm-hmm. And that'll be my big question. What do you want to accomplish with this gift? And they might be doing it by way of a trust or an annuity that will pay them income for life. But with the gift portion of it, they want to do something generally.
Correct.
And it might be, I want to endow a professorship. Or it might be, I want to endow a scholarship. Or it might be, I want to purchase a whatever for this organization. But that seems to be a real motivator for a lot of the people who I work with. They have something in mind that they want to do with their gift. And that quite often determines the size of the gift as well.
That's what I was referring to when I talked about the need of the individual. The individual has a need there to do something in the way of perpetuation of the educative process, as you were suggesting, and that they want to do that. One of the things that happens many times between donors and institutions is a disconnect. That in fact the institution sees its needs and what it wants money for differently than what the people are that they're soliciting. Then they wonder why they don't get the gift.
Yeah.
And part of that is they fail to spend the time learning what the donor prospect has in mind. Mm-hmm. What is it that in fact they might wish to give to? And as I suggested earlier, how then can our organization be for them a solution, an opportunity for them to fulfill the need that they have? Now, this changes the way in which changes the relationship between the donor prospect and the institution. I mean, I've worked 22 years in healthcare, and I'll tell you that, no offense to any physicians and others who might be in the room, but I have never worked with a group of people who consider themselves expert as people in healthcare do. And they don't want any input from anybody else as to how their money's going to be spent, because they know best. And when you start talking with a donor and the donor says, I'm interested in thinking about this, and the doctor says, no, no, my need is over here, your need doesn't matter. They shut the gift down. That's what you were referring to earlier, Art. Did I see a hand over here? Yes, I'm sorry.
Just one comment. That just kind of people in this room were real, there were a fairly small slice of the population just being able to be here to hold and having the means to get here. And this whole need for giving and the gifts you get from giving and whatever, achieving our full genetic potential, just so that we don't lose thought of money as being the gift, but providing many other ways of gifting, you know, for people who just don't have.
Yeah, and money is not the only gift. I mean, many people in the true sense of stewardship, time and their expertise and just their presence is an important gift. And if there's any place that's benefited from that, it's Holden, because of the thousands and thousands of individuals who have come forward and given their gifts of time, talents to this place. And you can't discount them. They are just as valuable as money. In fact, maybe more so in some ways, but they are just as valuable. Any other comment? Yeah, Eileen. Oh, excuse me, I should introduce Eileen and Ron Tellefson over here. Hold your hands up. They are the firm that is assisting Holden with our capital campaign, and they're here reporting to the board this week. And you all must go by them on your way out. No, we don't grease power. I'm sorry to coerce a little bit here, but I just wanted you to know
they're very nice people.
They are nice people. Let's go back.
I was going to address the question why the giving is so low, and I don't know the churches in St. Paul, but it has been our experience in working with churches, which is what Ron and I do most of the time, that money and stewardship issues are not talked about in our churches hardly ever. There's very little stewardship education. Children have no clue what stewardship means. Half of the adults do not know what the word tithe means. They think it means whatever I put into the offering plate on any given Sunday. And I think as a church as a whole, we have been very remiss in educating folks and giving them the opportunity to have the blessing of giving and being good stewards.
Well, I think too, we need to preach about money in terms of our relationship with God so that money doesn't become the God. And and if we don't preach in that way, money will become the God, or is the God, and will be even more the God for more and more of our people. So I don't see how we can avoid that issue. It's just a shame. And I think it's right. It needs to be preached about a lot more than it is.
There's a question right here, then we'll come over here. Yeah.
Well, one and sort of a footnote to that, our congregation has been going through a crisis the last 3 years now. And one of the things they've done, the stewardship committee has done in response to that, is we no longer tie it to our district. And so there's absolutely none of our funds are going to any outside program except our church. And so giving has dropped off, and a lot of people are giving outside anyways. I mean, they have then taken their tithe and gone outside to give to other organizations. I'm one of them. We're giving like half our tithe to the church and half to other organizations. Just because there's nothing there going, again, it's a self-interest. It's how are my needs being met? And I've tried to stand up and say, biblically, you know, you're not tithing, so how can you expect us to tithe to you? And it doesn't.
Question yes. Up here?
Right here, then up there. Okay. Yeah.
In addition to preaching, we've done something. We have raised the time of offering to a sacrament. And every person in the pew is invited to hold the plate and put in it their prayers, their intentions, their gifts. And we've got kids now who will grab that plate out of the hands of the usher because they don't want to be passed over. And it's turned around the attitude about giving. It's a holy moment.
Libby?
I'm confused because I have two images going on in my head. One is I think I think, fairly characterizes the Old Testament image of giving that is gay abandon. And giving to the point where tomorrow you start over again. You've not gotten ahead because you've given it away, whether it's burnt to God or to the community. There's life in that image. However, from an organizational point of view, the need to discover that individual's need makes a whole lot of sense sitting in a chair as a fundraiser. But to me, it sounds like a trap to fall into. You're stroking my ego. And I'm almost buying immortality when I fund that professor's chair or whatever. And that's it's, right. That frightens me a little bit.
And that's been to the methodology, and that's design. Yeah, I'm not
trapping?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah. It seems to me that when we talk about getting to the need of the individual and tying in the theological view of what it means to give, go along with it on your gene theory too, what we fail to do is to develop that need to give, which is a response to our own, what we have received, and somehow we translate the need that a person has into some other kind of need, such as the posterity or, you know, being famous or whatever. And as a church, we need to bring that gene idea into our innate need to give as a response. And I think that innate need to give as a response is, goes along then with the idea of denial. We deny that. And I think the church's role needs to bring that to the fore and get rid of the denial that we don't have a need to give as a response.
Our first purpose is to proclaim the gospel in such a way that people will trust in the Lord, right? And not in their money or anything else.
John, could you mentioned briefly grace and gratitude, and that's where we should be aiming. I was wondering if you could expand on that.
Not well yet. I'm sort of looking at those issues around some writing that I want to do for the future. But as I look at the drivers that have been out there, particularly the ones of guilt and coercion, I don't think those are going to hold up anymore in the future. I think they are passe. They're going away. People are too smart. Libby's catching on real fast, you know, and it's time that we move to something that has more depth and more meaning to it. But when we talk about grace in this room, we talk about it from a Christian and potentially Lutheran theological perspective, and yet most of the people that I deal with are not that, and they tend to want to, I'm trying to discover, in fact, is Dan Erlander here? Dan and I are supposed to talk about humanistic grace. Does anybody want to tell me what that is? I want to get into some ideas about humanistic grace, but also moving towards gratitude as a way of helping people see that giving is a fulfillment of something from within themselves and be grateful for that. I think the word was gratitude leads to graciousness or graciousness to gratitude. But did you use that in your sermon the other night? Or? Who was using that?
Well, Susan
used that at the board meeting.
In the board meeting.
And I just thought that was a wonderful phrase.
And gratitude engenders generosity.
Yes.
So there's a link between thankfulness and a posture of thankfulness to God and a thankfulness to one another that engenders generosity in one another. So that I think in caring for one another as the people of God, we have a way of engendering further giving from them, whether it be giving of a volunteer nature or giving of money or anything of substance.
Dan?
If you think of the religion of the God of money, one of the key precepts is scarcity. That anything, that there's never enough, and anything that you give away is something lost to you. Yeah. And I think that's one of the key precepts that are built into all of us, that somehow, and I think going back to the what Libby was saying about the Old Testament view of Jubilee and all those things, founded on that. It's founded on the idea that there is enough. Mm-hmm. There's more than enough. There's always more.
Yeah. And there's more than enough.
And that's the thing. I mean, that's not a matter of that there's not enough out there. Society, that we all have a scarcity.
Yeah, it's scarcity security, that thing going back and forth.
Right, yeah.
Yes, sir, then we'll come here.
I hate to chime this in, but I don't think that most people think of God as money. Because money is just a vehicle for buying goods and services. That's all it is.
Well, right, it's an idol.
No, it's a vehicle for buying goods and services.
It's not a neutral vehicle, not in the scriptures, not according to Jesus calls it mammon, which is a demonized understanding of that which stands for
money. Well, I don't want to spiritualize mine, but what I'm saying is that what money brings us is what we worship. Whether it brings us power, whether it brings us influence, it's not the money. If somebody's a jerk and they win the lottery, they'll still be a jerk. And if they're gracious when they win the lottery, they'll generally still be gracious. Unless the power corrupts. It's
money,
power that corrupts, and not
what
money
stands for. But I think at that point, you can't just say, from a faith point of view, that money is a neutral kind of commodity.
It is. If we're going to use addiction language, though, it's important to be clear that addiction is in a person. It is not in a bottle of alcohol or
in a food.
In a food or something like that. That what makes alcohol addictive is the way the person responds to it and the person's attachment to it. And so I think there is some important clarity there that this is. We give over so much power to this inanimate object,
and it is,
Luther says that to which the heart attaches itself is an idol. Then the idolatry is not in the thing to which it is attached, but the heart that is attached.
Yeah. Oh, Art had a comment here.
I think there are three types of people on the planet. Those who have a lot of money, those who got some, and those who got practically none. I've been all three. At PLU, as a student, when people go down and get a hamburger and a Coke, I get water, because I had no money. You talk about the people in the African-American church giving more. It's because they know what less is and how little hurts. And I know that, and I remember it. And then I finished up college, and I got a job, and I got married, and Laura said, "You can't outgive God." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you give away the money and you'll never miss it." And I said, "I'm sorry, this doesn't fit my mathematical equation." She said, "Well, let's go read the Bible." So we did that. And after a while, we started doing that, and doggone it, she wasn't right. In the last 5 to 10 years, we've been blessed financially in almost a ludicrous way through no doing of mine. It's absolutely grace. And I found that those who got a lot of money have a special calling to take that lot of money, whatever you call your lot of money, and use that to knock down the barrier of cant that people see as a result of not having money to do a particular entity. I can recount numerous cases where we have gone in and said, "We'll fund that because that's a good thing to do, okay? It's a good high return on investment. It's the right thing to do for whatever entity, and we'll fund it entirely to come up instead of it costing $5,000 or $8,000, it costs $500 because people became empowered because the obstacle of money got out of the way. And that then empowers the other people to give with what they have rather than being stuck in camp. So I would encourage people to look at what they have and think of what they have as maybe a lot of money, especially if you go back to when you've been poor, because most people in this room know what poor is. They've lived it at some time in their life. Now I'll shut up.
You know, we've reached, I think, the first time in the history of humankind that one individual is worth $100 billion. Bill Gates. His net worth is over $100 billion. Yes, sir.
Looking at the numbers, that you put up on the board and the turnover that we're going to see in the next 15 years or less, on one side there's a large danger there that money is going to become God to a lot of people, because a lot of people are going to be thinking very seriously about all that money that they're going to change from one generation to another. And some of that, as that money is prepared to change hands, some of it's tied up in, for whatever reason, real estate, some things that can't be readily liquidated, or they can be, but we're looking at penalties and taxes and that sort of thing. How important is timing to the things that you do as far as fundraising? And the things that the church can do.
Was that asked as a question?
Mm-hmm. Yes. How important is timing on approaching people when that transition is taking place in their life?
Well, the timing is an individual thing. Timing in working with an individual is built around the relationship you have with that individual as a professional fundraiser, and how, in fact, at the appropriate time, you can be an aid to them in providing information, education, and opportunity when their timing is right. There are people that will try to manage that process to the point to where they will go in and try to scoop that money out from people before they have a chance to make some decision. But successful fundraising, currently and long-term, is a relationship business. It's developed around the relationship an individual has who represents a particular institution and the beliefs and mission of that institution, in relationship with an individual who also feels something towards that institution. And so, if that relationship is there, then as the timing comes, as the asset moves, they're going to invite you to chat with them about how they can maximize their giving through that process. You know, one of the things this whole surplus we have going in the United States budget right now is predicated long-term by our actuarial friends based upon how much of this money is going to turn over and go to the government in the estate tax and inheritance tax side. So there's going to be a lot of things over there. Our planned giving folks would love to give into this one.
I want to point to Art, who shared his own personal story a moment ago. We find that one of the most empowering aspects of giving and motivating and giving in congregations in special campaigns, usually capital campaigns, are people who would say, there was a time when I had very little, then at another time I had some, and now I have a lot. And we ask a few people to share their personal story to the point where they'll say, we plan for the sake of St. John's Lutheran Church to contribute $10,000 a year for the next 3 years in order to make this ministry possible. And that's on top of the tithe that we normally give. What it does, it gets beyond percentages, it gets down to the tangible, that people will remember a number, they won't remember a percentage. It also is very freeing for the person who's told the story. We also have people who have modest means who tell their story, who may give $1,000 a year, and we find that that's wonderfully motivating, but terribly scary, and it's scary because of the idolatry nature of money, I think, essentially. But I think, Art, I appreciate your sharing and admitting. I think if we were to confess as a church, I am rich, unfortunately, we have a lot of us who are still in the shadow of a depression who imagine ourselves to be poor when in fact we're rich. Most North Americans are rich. Compared to the Guatemalans or the Namibians or some other third world country. But I think it's very important that we become honest about our wealth.
As we move here towards the end of the time we had together, in a couple of minutes, since we do all need to go to Vespers, there's a couple of models that I'd like to lay out for you to think about from your own perspective in working within your church or within those organizations that you are part of. And one is that the future successful fundraising activity will be focused around the whole question or issue of partnering. finding ways to invite people inside your organization, inside your church, to actually be active partners within the life of that church. Now, that sounds like something we've been doing for a long time. But what it means is that those people who lead those organizations are now going to have to open their organizations up to allow others to participate inside with them. The major donors, the donors of the future, want that. They do not want to be told what to do. They want to come in and participate inside of the life of the organization. This will change dramatically the way organizations will have to structure themselves, how churches will have to structure themselves as they open up to allow these people to express their lives inside of that organization's mission and vision. And as they do that, their wallets, their pocketbooks, and their assets will come with them. And that will be the successful future model from my perspective. Any last comments you want to make?
I was going to ask John about this information about the 20 trillion. What should that mean to us as Christians?
Opportunity. Tremendous opportunity is that is made available to each of us in whatever way and whichever part we get. Because in some ways it's found money. It's not earned like everyday green money is, it's brown money, it's asset money.
But it's a tremendous responsibility as well.
Absolutely.
Both individually for what you do with your own family situation and how you provide leadership within the community of relationship to which you belong to help guide that to a positive outcome as opposed to a negative outcome.
Go
ahead and close.
I was just going to say what I hope that we maybe help you to do tonight is to think about money as an issue, both from the biblical point of view as well as from a secular point of view, from all points of view, so that you can go home and try to get in conversation with people in your congregations, your pastor and others in your neighborhood about money and its meaning in your life so that you and others can reflect upon that. I think that's really important that we talk about money. There's a story about two psychologists who, in their way of doing things, would talk in front of their kids about anything, but when they talked about money, they went in the bedroom and closed the door. I think there is some of that taboo business about money. I hope that you will go home and encourage your congregations and your fellow believers to talk about money and to talk about it in terms of it, its dangers in becoming a god for us.
Thank you all for being here.